Thanks to donors like you, Aquinas 101 is setting the world aflame with the truth, but the next season can't be filmed without your help. Dozens of new episodes are planned, but they'll only be brought to life if you make them possible. Your gift by October 31st will bring the truth to students, families, and people around the world. Please use the link in the episode description below to give today.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
I'm going to read, for the most part, from a prepared lecture because I've made this joke before. The purpose of this lecture is basically to cover, in an introductory fashion, what I would have covered in the first like 2 or 3 months of philosophy of nature course here at the House of Studies. That joke is hopefully funny. It's also true. So you've got a handout. The way to think about the purpose of this talk, as Father said, very general overview, especially for anyone in the room who does not have this terminology, doesn't have the background, okay? And what we'll find as we get into the other philosophy talks and in the conversations in the next couple of days is that the questions for the Aristotelian and Thomistic tradition of philosophical inquiry concerning something like the nature of light, there are just going to be questions that are framed in terms of the notions that I'm introducing in this lecture. All right, so the notions, the terminology that I'm going to introduce in this lecture include the notions of substance and accident, along with Aristotle's categories of being, the kinds of change distinguished by Aristotle, Aristotle's four causes, the notions of form and matter, along with hylomorphism, the notions of act and potency. I'm going to do something that I haven't done in previous versions of this lecture and talk a little bit about Aristotle's understanding of motion or change, his definition of motion, as well as a thesis that he has about the relationship between a mover and a moved thing, an agent and a patient. I'm trying to pitch this so that it will be helpful for notions that are going to come up in discussion of the nature of light in the scholastic tradition and in philosophical considerations of light. So for each of these notions, the goal is I'm going to explain the meaning of these key terms. I'm going to try to provide some key examples. And then I will articulate some of the sorts of scientific or philosophical questions that can be asked using these notions. And of course, I hope to be helpful in articulating the sorts of questions at issue in this year's symposium concerning the nature of light. So without further ado, we'll begin with Aristotle's distinction between substance and accident. The distinction between substance and accident is central to Aristotelian metaphysics, that is his philosophical study of being, and it plays a central role from the very beginning of his general study of nature in his work that has come down to us as the Physics. In brief, an answer to the question, what is there, or what kinds of entities or beings are there in reality? That is, if we were to take a sort of metaphysical census, as it were, of the world, and list all of the things that truly are beings or entities, Aristotle's answer is that the world is populated by independent, unified, whole, distinct beings or entities of various kinds. And these are the things that we call substances. These substances also have various features, which Aristotle calls accidents, in addition to being what they are as substances. Examples of substances would include this cat, that oak tree, this human being, that block of marble, that diamond. These are independent beings, beings not inherent in another. They are unified as one being rather than a collection of beings. They are wholes, which may have various parts, but are not themselves parts of some larger substance. They are each of some kind, as cats, oak trees, human beings, marble, and diamond are different kinds of things. Now, as the founder of biology and of biological taxonomy, the paradigmatic substances in which Aristotle is most interested are organisms, living things. Aristotle also seems to think of the elemental or simplest bodies and of various homogeneous compounds resulting from the mixture of the elements as substances. So looking around the room that we're in now, Aristotle would identify each human being as a substance. He would identify the air we breathe as a substance. He would not, however, identify the tables, the chairs, the air conditioners as substances. He would instead say that these artifacts are arrangements of several substances, such as some kind of wood, some kind of metal, some kind of plastic, and so on. For Aristotle, these artificial things are not of some kind in the relevant sense. They are kinds, which is to say, kinds or species of substance. And they are not independent insofar as they depend for their being upon the substances of which they are composed. For Aristotle, although substances can come to be from the composition of simple or material kinds, nevertheless, no substance has distinct substances as its parts. No part of a substance is itself a substance in the sense of an independent, unified being of a particular kind. If you haven't encountered this claim before, it is a rather surprising claim. For Aristotle, I as an individual human being, as I am a human being, I'm a substance. And although my liver and my right arm are parts of me, they are not distinct substances. Nor are my cells, nor their cellular parts, their molecular parts, and so on. None of these are distinct substances, notwithstanding the fact that things like water and carbon can also exist independently as substances when they're not part of and unified within a substance like me. All right, that is the quickest introduction to the notion of substance for Aristotle. Okay. But again, it's metaphysical senses. What is there? Okay, the world is filled and populated by substances, individual beings of certain kinds, and those substances have, in addition to being what they are as substances, the features that Aristotle calls accidents. So accidents, again, are the various features possessed by substances in addition to being the kind of thing that they are as substances. Most of the things identified by Aristotle as accidents are changeable features of a substance. For example, that a cat is over here or over there, that water is hot or cold, that a human being is honest. Being over there, heat, and honesty are all accidents, as something can be a cat without being over there, something can be water without being hot, and something can be a human being without being honest. Unlike substances, which are independent, accidents are dependent, inhering in and belonging to substances. And it's at this point that we can introduce Aristotle's 10 categories. These are both the 10 kinds of predicates, that is, things signified by the predicate term in a proposition of the form S is P. And we will also say they are, for Aristotle, the 10 kinds or modes of beings, or ways or modes that things are. There are 10 categories, one of which is substance. There are thus 9 kinds of accidental predicates, or 9 accidental modes of being. So the 10 categories: substance, quantity, quality, relation, where, when, position, habit, action, and passion. To give examples of each, many of these are taken straight from Aristotle's categories. Again, substance, a horse, a human being. Quantity, 3 feet or 2 gallons. Quality, and this will be a very important category for thinking about all the sorts of Aristotelian philosophical questions concerning the nature of light. First examples of quality: blue, the color blue, cold, triangular, and honest, okay, qualities of character. Examples of relation, being greater than or lesser than, being the father of or the son of. In the category of where or place, in the priory or in theological college. In the category of when, at noon, last year. In the category of position, being sitting or being standing. So there we're talking about the arrangement of the parts of something like me. Okay. The category of habit, being clothed or being armed. For Thomas, this is a category that even is peculiar to human beings. We're the sorts of things that are equipped or, well, that have habits. Okay. All right, and then also particularly important for thinking about questions surrounding the nature of light, action and passion. So examples of action, heating, pushing, and examples of passion, being heated, being pushed. All right, what's very important, and especially for thinking about the nature, that these questions concerning the nature of light, it's very important that one can know that something is a being and yet not be certain about which category it belongs to, including whether it is a substance or an accident. And in fact, the classic example of this from medieval philosophy, particularly important for Scotus, but it's still a good point, very relevant for our theme this year, okay, is the famous example is the rainbow. One can know that rainbows exist. One can know that rainbows are a reality and yet not be sure of what they are, even whether they are substances or some accident, whether it's an accident of air or an accident of light, if light was thought itself to be a substance rather than a quality, okay, or whatever it is that light is. Okay. So you can know what something is, know that something is a being, without knowing where to place it within the categories. So one of the central Aristotelian questions concerning physical phenomena is going to be, to what category does this belong? Okay. All right, so we've spent a little bit of time on the notions of substance and accident. Again, these are notions central to Aristotle's metaphysics. Okay. These notions are in the background of all of the important notions in Aristotle's natural philosophy. And now we'll begin to talk about things more peculiar to natural philosophy. All right, so next we should say something about the notions of substantial change and accidental change. It is obvious on Aristotle's view that accidental change occurs, that is, that change occurs with respect to accidents, as a substance can change where it is, or it can change in its qualities, like its temperature or its shape, or it can change in its size. Such accidental features come to be and pass away, or rather substances come to be in some qualified accidental way and cease to be in some qualified accidental way. If things like oak trees, cats, and human beings are substances, then it's also the case that substances themselves come to be and pass away, as this human being did not exist 100 years ago, and this human being will one day pass away. Aristotelians thus distinguish between accidental change and substantial change. Now, many reductionists and the Empedoclean and atomist reductionists with whom Aristotle was familiar deny the reality of substantial change. They deny that anything absolutely comes to be or passes away, instead holding that the things that are, the elements or the atoms, merely undergo various changes of place, mixing in different arrangements. All right, as we'll discuss later a little bit, Aristotle's causal explanation of substantial change differs in some very important ways from his explanation of accidental change. But to explain how this is so, at this point, we need to introduce Aristotle's famous four causes, including especially the notions of form and matter. All right, the four causes distinguished by Aristotle can best be thought of at first pass as the four kinds of answers to the question why. or as four kinds of explanations for why something is the way that it is. Looking at John Boyer to see if he's happy with what I just said. This is okay. His dissertation concerns all the questions surrounding what I just said. Okay. All right. As the causes are all, in fact, for Aristotle, beings or real features or principles of beings, such a first-pass account isn't quite adequate, but this is an introductory lecture. St. Thomas offers as a definition of the notion of cause the following. A cause is that upon which something depends for its being or its coming to be. Following Aristotle's usage of these three terms at the beginning of his Physics, St. Thomas situates the meaning of cause in comparison to two other fundamentally important notions, namely principle and element. An element is, according to St. Thomas, quote, a first component of a thing and is in it. For example, words are made of syllables, and syllables are made of letters. Both syllables and letters are thus components of words, but the letters are the elements, the first components, because the proximate components of words are themselves made of letters. In fact, the word for element in Greek is also the word for letter. The elements are the letters of physical things. As we have said, a cause is that upon which something depends, according to St. Thomas, for its being or its coming to be. An element is thus an example of a cause, as a thing does depend upon its elements for its coming to be. If there were no carbon, living things would not come to be. And carbon is somehow or another in living things, although exactly how this is so for Aristotle is less straightforward than one might have thought, as I said before. The point is that all elements are causes. An element is a particular kind of cause, but there are also causes that are not elements. As, for example, when I lift something, I am a cause of its coming to be in a certain place, but I am not a component of it, let alone a first or fundamental component. Principle is an even more general notion than cause. The notion of a principle only, quote, implies some order of a process or progression. St. Thomas's example is that a point is a principle of a line, although it is not a cause. That is, the order of the parts of a line is relative to and explained or articulated in terms of points, but lines do not depend upon points as causes. Most importantly, lines are not made of points. Points are not parts of lines, as one cannot make something extended out of unextended parts. So there are things that may serve as explanations, as what St. Thomas would call principles, without being a cause. As, for example, a point is a principle used in explaining or articulating a line, but a point is not a cause of a line. As again, a point is not a thing upon which a line depends for its being or its coming to be. So the four causes are thus the four kinds of things upon which something depends for its being or its coming to be. And at this point, we can list Aristotle's four causes and give a basic explanation and some examples. So the efficient cause or moving cause, the agent or moving cause that makes something to be. Efficient causality is the most familiar notion of cause in ordinary English, right? If we say that something causes something else, we usually think of something that acts upon something as an extrinsic agent. The material cause is that out of which something comes to be, or that out of which something is made. And the material cause is always something that is in the thing of which it is the cause. So wood is a material cause for this podium, okay? The formal cause, Aristotle first articulates the formal cause as the very essence of something or the definition signifying the essence. As many Thomists put it, a formal cause is what makes a thing to be what it is. Okay. So In the case of the podium, what makes the wood to be a podium is the shape and arrangement of the wood, okay, as opposed to being a table or being a chair. And finally, a final cause is that for the sake of which something is, or that for the sake of which something comes to be. Okay. As facilitating giving a talk is the final cause for the podium. Okay. That for the sake of which, okay, something is. Now, the classic first example used to introduce the four causes in introductions to Aristotle is typically a statue. Okay, so why is something a statue, or why or how has a statue come to be? We can articulate in terms of the four causes, we can offer an account of the being of the statue. So the efficient cause of a statue is the sculptor who made the statue. The material cause of a statue is the marble from which it was carved. The formal cause of the statue is the shape of the statue, since it's a particular shape that makes marble to be a statue. Now, we can note that the matter, the marble, comes to possess the form or the shape by the agency of the efficient cause. And this is generally how St. Thomas thinks about the relationship between efficient, material, and formal causes in physical things. Efficient causes cause the information of matter. And lastly, the statue is made for the sake of something, for example, to honor the person depicted. Aristotle's first example is that health is the final cause of walking. And in his biology, he identifies functions of living things as final causes of organs, as the heart is for the circulation of blood, and the neck is for the sake of eating and breathing, as it protects the esophagus in animals with lungs. For Aristotle and Thomas, the final cause is in a way the most important of the causes, as we have a final cause whenever we have some effect that tends to result from some agent. This means that efficient causality is always ordered by, or even defined with respect to, final causality. So in physical things, what agents or efficient causes do is to bring it about that matter receives some form. So material and formal causes depend upon efficient causes, and efficient causes depend upon final causes. For this reason, St. Thomas says that the final cause is the cause of causes. All right, we don't need to say more, however, at this point about final causality in this introductory lecture, but we do need to give a little bit more attention to the notions of form and matter and to what contemporary philosophers now call hylomorphism, the view held by Aristotle that physical substances are all composed of matter and form. Now, this theme maybe is a little less important. For discussion of the nature of light. Okay, but no introduction to Aristotelian natural philosophy would be complete without mention of his hylomorphism. Right, so matter is, again, as it were, the stuff out of which something is made, and matter is somehow in that which has been made from it. When something is made from matter, this is so because matter has received some new form. And we can give examples of both accidental changes and substantial changes. When water goes from being cold to being hot, the water is the matter in relation to being hot water, and heat is the form that the water comes to possess. When a human being becomes knowledgeable, the human being, or some capacity within the human being, is the matter in relation to being a knowledgeable human, and knowledge is the form that the human being comes to possess. In these cases, it is the accident itself that is the form acquired by a substance that did not previously possess it. So one should think first and foremost of the things identified by Aristotle as qualities in thinking about accidents as forms. Matters are a little bit more complicated, however, in the case of substantial change, and this is really where the theory of hylomorphism comes into play. Substantial change is more complicated given Aristotle's commitment to certain claims concerning substance. And as I said before, a substance is an independent, unified, whole entity of a particular kind, and no substance has actual substances distinct from itself as its parts. So if a substance comes to be, it cannot be the case that any of the previously existing substances from which it was generated persist actually in it as distinct parts. Assuming, for the sake of an example, that the generation of water from hydrogen and oxygen is an instance of substantial change, which is what we must say if we say that water is a substance, as most contemporary Aristotelians and Thomists would say, then hydrogen and oxygen don't exist actually as parts of water. But then that means hydrogen and oxygen cannot themselves be most truly the matter of water, in the way that water is analogously the matter of heated water. That is, hydrogen and oxygen aren't what receive the form of being water. So what does receive this form? It's here that Aristotle and St. Thomas introduced the notion of prime matter as the ultimate underlying subject of physical change. St. Thomas characterizes prime matter as pure potentiality for substantial forms. Prime matter never exists independently on its own. It is always informed by some substantial form or another. When one or more substances pass away, and one or more substances come to be in their place, this underlying potentiality is the subject of the forms in question, both the forms possessed before the change and the form or forms possessed after the change. So I like to focus on the example of hydrogen and oxygen becoming water because it is rather counterintuitive. For many people to say that the matter of that change actually isn't hydrogen and oxygen, okay, but rather some more fundamental potentiality underlying being hydrogen and being oxygen. Okay. Now, everything I've said, I said that most contemporary Aristotelians and Thomists will defend the claim that water is a substance and will think of this as an example of substantial change, but this is itself a controversial question. Okay. And there are very nuanced and complicated answers that contemporary Aristotelians and Thomists who work on this will offer about this particular case. The purpose for this introductory lecture, introducing the notion of hylomorphism, is just to make clear that there may be, first, some initially counterintuitive claims advanced if you accept hylomorphism. If you accept that something like water is a substance in Aristotle's sense, then the change by which water comes to be is going to be a substantial change, and substances don't have other actual substances as their parts. So you have to say, strictly, hydrogen and oxygen pass away when water comes to be, even if there is some very important and interesting relationship between the nature of hydrogen and oxygen and the nature of water. All right, so this is to speak somewhat conditionally, to say if you accept the Aristotelian distinction between substance and accident, if you accept that a particular thing is a substance, then you're going to be committed to the claim that when this substance comes to be, the components from which it was generated pass away. Okay. And this is why Aristotle and Thomas posit the notion of prime matter as the underlying ultimate underlying subject of all change. So hylomorphism is the theory that all physical substances are substantially composed of form and matter. St. Thomas's version of hylomorphism is explicit in the claim that in a given substance there is one and only one substantial form. This is the thesis of the unicity of substantial form. For Aristotle and St. Thomas, souls are substantial forms, a substantial form that makes a living thing to be this or that kind of organism. So in the case of the human being, St. Thomas explicitly holds that a human soul is the single substantial form of a given human being. All right. Much more obviously could be said about the notions of matter and form and the notion of hylomorphism. One of the questions with respect to light is going to be, well, where is it situated within the categories? And if you think of light as itself like a body, and you're thinking of it like it's in the category of substance, then you're going to have, if you're an Aristotelian, the question of, from what is it, what are its components, from what is it composed? All right, at this point, I want to shift gears a little bit and introduce a few notions from Book 3 of Aristotle's Physics that I think will be helpful for and necessary for articulating some of the questions that we're going to be addressing concerning the nature of light from an Aristotelian or Thomistic perspective. Now, I've already used the language of actuality and potentiality a couple of times. We need these notions in order to talk about how Aristotle thinks about what motion or change in general is. The notions of actuality and potentiality are fundamental in Aristotle's philosophy of being and in his philosophy of nature. We can say that the notions of actuality and potentiality are discovered and known through analogies. So, for example, as a human being able to speak stands in comparison to a human being actually speaking. And as a pile of lumber is to a house, and as an unripe tomato is to a ripe tomato, and as a cat able to be over there stands in relationship to a cat actually over there, and on and on and on. Okay, these are the general notions of potentiality and actuality. So potentiality or potency is what can be. Potential comes from the Latin participle potens, able to be. What has being in a complete or full way, by contrast, is what is actual or what has actuality. Now, Aristotle employs the notions of actuality and potentiality in his response to the famous problem of Parmenides. Parmenides is unable to account for the possibility or the reality of change because he only distinguishes between being and non-being. Something either is or it isn't, and there can't be any transition from what is not to what is. Central to one of the ways that Aristotle responds to the problem of Parmenides is this distinction between actuality and potentiality. Okay. That potentiality is a way that things are. That something is able to be is, we could say, a real feature. So reality for Aristotle is not just what actually is now. Reality also includes what can be, is included within being. So being is not just the actual, being also includes potentiality. Putting the point in a more metaphysical way, and mentioning again the notion of the categories, Aristotle holds that actuality and potentiality divide all of the categories. This just means that for any being or entity in the categories, it is one thing for something to actually be, and it is another for it to potentially be. And with respect to anything you place in any of the categories, right, something can actually be such and such, or things can potentially be such and such. All right, the notions of actuality and potentiality are necessary for us to talk about Aristotle's understanding of motion. So Aristotle notes in his treatment of his definition of motion in Physics Book 3, the difficulty of defining motion. Motion or change is such a fundamental and familiar notion. In fact, Aristotle thinks that the science, the philosophy of nature begins just with the recognition as obvious that things do change. Okay. St. Thomas's first way of proving God's existence famously begins, "It is evident to the senses," right, that in the world things undergo change or motion. So change or motion is such a familiar and fundamental notion, as is often the case. The most fundamental and familiar notions are, in fact, the most difficult to define well, because we define things with respect to more fundamental and basic notions. So the most basic and fundamental notions are the most difficult to articulate or define well. Aristotle's definition of motion depends upon the insight that, having distinguished between actuality and potentiality, as two ways that things are, we could say two modes of being, motion or change is a way or mode of being that is between potency and actuality. So something can be at rest, rest being the absence of motion, we could say in two different ways, or in two different respects. First, something can be at rest insofar as it is merely potential with respect to some actuality. As the cat that's here is at rest, it's potentially over there. It's not on the way to being over there. It is merely in potency with respect to this other possible actual state. Or the cat could be at rest actually being over there. So there's two different aspects or respects in which you can think of something at rest, okay? Insofar as it is actually a certain way, or insofar as it is potentially a certain way, but not changing, not on its way to possessing that actuality. So potency, again, is the ability to be. To say that something is potential, to say that there's potency of something, is just to say that it is able to be such and such a way. Potency is also, therefore, the ability to come to be, or to be brought to be a certain way. In fact, St. Thomas goes as far in his commentary on the Metaphysics as indicating that, expositing some things that Aristotle says, to say that something is potentially such and such always implies the existence of something that can make it to actually be such and such. So water is potentially hot because there exist things like fire. So to talk about one thing being potentially such and such is to imply the existence of something that can bring it about that it's actually such and such. And this is why the notion of motion immediately leads one to thinking about efficient causality and the relationship between things that are moved and their movers. Okay, so potency is the ability to be. It's the ability to come to be brought to be. All right, what is motion or change for Aristotle? So, thinking about the cat that's on the way to being over there, or the house that is being built, being constructed out of lumber, Aristotle defines motion as the actuality of what exists in potentiality insofar as it exists in potentiality. So exactly as the ability to be a way that something isn't yet, okay, when that potentiality is actual, still as a potentiality, that is motion or change. Okay. Now this is a rather abstract, okay? A very general definition of motion. It does not apply only to changes of place. It would apply just as well to changes with respect to quality or changes with respect to quantity, even in a certain way, but this is more complicated, to change with respect to substance. In Aristotle's discussion of this definition of motion, just as against Parmenides, he emphasizes that potentiality is a true way of being. Potentiality is real. Act and potency divide being. So in his discussion of motion, he's critical of his own teacher, Plato. Plato had thought of motion or change as other than being. Okay, motion or change is not really being. And so motion or change wouldn't really fall under the categories in any way. The way to think about this is that for Aristotle, again, every being or entity falls within the categories. There are actual beings, there are potential beings, and then there are the things that are on their way. Okay. So undergoing a change of place for Aristotle is an imperfect way or an incomplete way of being with respect to being in place. Okay. Or undergoing a change of color. Something is imperfect in between the state of merely potentially being that color and actually possessing that color. So motion or change is this. Another way that Aristotle puts it is to say that motion is imperfect or incomplete act. Okay, motion is incomplete actuality. And this is why Aristotle says, he makes this comment in Physics Book 3, this is why motion or change is difficult to grasp. It's very easy for us to think about actuality. Something is this. This is red, right? This is warm. This is a cat. Okay? It's very easy to think about potentiality because potentiality is just the ability to be in a certain way. Motion or change is a little more elusive, okay? Because it's somehow in between potentiality and actuality. All right, the final thesis from just a little bit later from Physics Book 3, Chapter 3 that I want to mention, and this will be the topic on which we conclude, it, I think, is helpful for thinking about all sorts of questions that come up in discussion of the nature of light, what Aristotle thinks color is, and so on. Aristotle advances a very important thesis in Physics 3.3 concerning what we can call the identity of actuality between mover and moved. Okay. So I know this has moved very quickly. Okay. One should think of just a very simple... Oh, I shouldn't pick up the... I was going to pick up the thing recording the lecture. I probably shouldn't wave this around too much. Okay. All right. Okay. I'll take the piece of paper. Okay. Stick to a change of place. Easiest and most obvious examples of change for us are changes of place. Okay. All right, the piece of paper potentially being over here. Right now it's at rest. Okay, later it will actually be over here. Okay. When the thing is in motion, Aristotle thinks, okay, the very ability for this to be over there is actual, but still as a potentiality. Okay. And that ability to be over there is also the very ability to be brought or made to be over there. Okay. Now, in this case, thinking about the four causes, I am the agent or the efficient cause that's making the thing to be over there. Okay. So right after he's introduced his definition of motion, right after he's defended the claim that motion is a way that things are, motion or becoming is not non-being, motion is a way of being. Again, this is an anti-Platonic point. The question is, okay, what's the relationship between the thing that causes motion, the mover, and the thing that is moved? And this is a problem that's occasioned by just how we talk about change and how we talk about causes of change. So you could say something like, Brian moves the paper. Okay? That makes it sound like there's an actuality in me, right? That makes it sound like I'm actually a certain way when I move the paper, okay? The paper is undergoing the change of place, okay? that's a certain sort of actuality. Again, this incomplete, imperfect actuality when the thing is actually moving. Okay. All right, Aristotle's answer to this, he introduces it as a rather complicated, somewhat difficult question. He poses two questions. He asks first, well, where really is motion? We say that Brian moves the paper and we say the paper is moved. Like, where is motion, or what really has motion? Well, he says, obviously it's the paper, right? Because again, motion with respect to place is an imperfect way, an incomplete way of being with respect to place. But what about the mover? Like, what does it mean to say, I move the paper? And this is where Aristotle advances the thesis that the actuality of the mover as a mover just is the actuality of the thing that's moved insofar as it's moved, okay? And the way to try to make this intuitive, okay, is to note the difference between these two cases, the case in which I am a mover, okay, and the paper is being moved, and this case where I'm the same way, my hand is undergoing its own motion in the same way, but now suddenly ignoring the air. I am no longer a mover, or at least I'm no longer a paper mover. Okay. So the difference between the case in which my arm moves like this and I'm not a mover, and the case in which my arm moves in the same way and now I am a mover, well, what's different in the world? What's different is that there's a change happening for the piece of paper, that there's motion or incomplete being for the paper. Okay. Now, the reason why this is an important thesis to bring up, it's a little bit more, not something I would normally try to introduce in 5 minutes, but for discussion of color, discussion of light, Aristotle in the De Anima employs this claim about the identity of actuality between mover and moved when he's discussing sensation and even in particular vision. Because he thinks of sensible objects as agents that move us to the activity of sensation. Okay? So my act as a mover really is the motion in the paper. And Aristotle analogously will say the activity of the sensible as such is the activity in the one sensing, because sensible objects move us. In discussion of light, there are going to be lots of questions articulated with respect to the categories, with respect to the four causes, with respect to certain subdivisions within the categories, with respect to the distinction between agents and patients. And this thesis about the identity of actuality between agent and patient is important, especially for discussion of, even for Aristotle, for the notion of color. All right, I know that's a very quick summary overview. Again, this would be like a couple of months in the Philosophy of Nature course, okay? But you have the handout. For those for whom this is truly first pass introduction to Aristotle's Philosophy of Nature, you have this a cheat sheet for the following days of the conference. We do have a little bit of time for Q&A, but I think the role of this lecture is to sort of set things up for the lectures to come. I can answer a few questions, but thank you all for your attention.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.